I love scotch. 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 Scotch.
Yep. Have another whiskey.
If you'd like to speak to me in person, press 1. If you'd like to order drugs, press hash.
I had a gentleman in the crowd that was like, tell me how to drink Glenfiddich. And I was like, I will not do that.
Yep.
You drink Glenfiddich how you want to drink Glenfiddich.
Wear a cowboy hat in Los Angeles and look at the amount of looks you get.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. This is the most flamboyant city on earth. You wear a cowboy hat, people look at you like you are like an alien.
The Beatles came on and they picked me up on his shoulder. George Harrison is as close to me as that wall now. I went, all right, George, all right. And he went, cough. And that was the closest I ever came to the Beatles.
Have a whiskey while we...
Yeah, let's do it again.
Yeah, yeah.
Cheers, long.
Cheers.
So welcome back to United States of Dramerica, and following on from our election special, I think we're going to be talking a little bit more about politics this week. I am delighted and intrigued to have as a guest a gentleman called John Cypher, 28 years in the CIA's clandestine service, and now a writer, public speaker, the man that people in the movie business and the news business want to go to for their information about what's going on. Welcome to the show, John Cypher.
Glad to be here. People who... I mean, every kind of business that doesn't pay, so.
Including not being paid to appear on this podcast. I guess we have to go straight into this. You know, you worked for the government a while ago now, but for, you know, for a significant period of your career. Could you ever imagine that where we are today is how the US would be led?
No, not at all. In fact, you know, it's funny. I think I heard someone say recently a comment that, you know, diplomats and intelligence officers are really good at sort of understanding foreign countries that they live in, but maybe not so good at understanding their own country. And I feel like that now. Like I could never imagine, you know, I'm embarrassed by what's become of this and by President Trump. And, you know, we have a president who doesn't seem to be interested in governing. He's interested in sort of fighting political battles and smearing enemies and marketing himself and making money, but the actual business of government and national security seems of no interest to him whatsoever. And having represented the United States around, you know, and you understand this as well, around the world, you know, if you don't always agree with the policies, that's okay. You're trying to protect your country and protect American citizens. And for the most part, the mission is something you can sign up to. But at this point, we're making our country the kind of corrupt, you know, countries that I worked against around the world.
In 28 years, you will have served for obviously administrations both sides.
Yep.
And as you say, you may have agreed or disagreed, but there was presumably when you were in the service, there was no point where you felt that, you know, America wasn't being led in a way you were comfortable with, even if you didn't agree with the specific policy directions.
That's right. And you know, as you understand too, having been in your service, is that, you know, public servants and people who work in national security, intelligence, in the military, law enforcement, FBI, things like that, they're public servants and they're professionals. And they're about trying to help policymakers understand what's happening around the world and all these kind of things. Politics doesn't really weigh into it. So I worked for everybody from Ronald Reagan to Bill Clinton to Barack Obama and George both Bushes. And the job really didn't change that much. And the people I work with day in and day out, sometimes in dangerous places and sometimes not, we never talked about politics or being a Republican or being a Democrat or working for this president or that president. It just wasn't part of the conversation. In fact, it wasn't until I retired and got on, you know, some of these social media sites that I even found out what the politics of my friends were. And I think that's the comfort zone for people who work in national security and foreign policy, is they, you know, they see themselves as, you know, taking an oath to the Constitution and trying to defend the country as best they can. And sort of these sort of sleazy political games are something that they're very, very uncomfortable being part of.
If you were still in now, would you have considered resigning at any point in the last 4 years?
I probably yes, in the sense that, you know, by the time I retired, I was fairly senior, and therefore you have some sort of responsibility and you're dealing with Washington and the White House. I also do believe there's a lot of young, probably professionals who are able to put their head down and focus on, you know, if you're living in India and you're on your second tour and you can be there for 3-4 years, you could focus on doing your job without getting too caught up in you know, what's happening in Washington. It may still bother you, and it may get to a point where you may have to leave. And perhaps if Trump had won again, there may have been a number of people who said, okay, listen, we could put up with one bad president, but now he's starting to radically change, you know, the way we do our business. And so CIA is an interesting place in the sense that it is more divorced from Washington sleazy politics and stuff. And so we've spent our careers overseas. We're focused on meeting people and representing the country and trying to do our job and trying to provide intelligence into the system. So if things were sort of messed up in Washington, you could hide out and stay overseas and wait till it was a little better till you come back. But if you're senior and, you know, you sort of have to deal with other institutions, the State Department and FBI and the White House and things, I think it'd be very, very hard to represent this administration. In fact, you know, Gina, I replaced her in a job that's director of the CIA now. You know, it seems to me that if I was in that position, there are a number of things that I just wouldn't have been able to take. And Trump put you in a position where you either have to sort of be complicit in something or, you know, keep your pride. And I would hope that, you know, I would have kept my pride and took off.
If you were to receive a call now, well, not now, after January the 20th, and, you know, somebody said, sort of, do you want to sort of come back and help bring things back into sort of maybe a little bit more order? Is that something that you would be interested in, or are you too far out and it's not your role anymore?
More the latter. I like being home. You know, I traveled around the world often. You know, people are now talking about missing Christmas or Thanksgiving because of COVID. I missed a lot of those when I was overseas, you know, kids' births and Christmas and seeing family and stuff. So I'm in a comfortable place now. There's certain jobs that might appeal to me, you know, being an ambassador somewhere or some other things. But, you know, a lot of those jobs are really hard, really a grind. And I'm in a place now where I'm doing, you know, I'm commenting on things and I'm working on content and stuff with Hollywood, which is really fun. And so it would have to be something unique to make it worthwhile. But I do hope a lot of friends that I know and work with will consider going back to help out this administration. But the one thing I have to say about the Biden, you know, the upcoming Biden administration, is they have no shortage of talented people ready to come back and work. I mean, Trump, you know, Team Trump is sort of pretty unqualified and not serious. And there's a lot of people ready to come back and help get things going. And it's not like they need me.
So just in terms of the transition, so, I mean, obviously, we're a whiskey show. We don't do politics as usual, as it were. And this almost isn't even about politics. But from your point of view, forgetting the politics of concession on sort of principle and so on, and the election itself, just in terms of the danger of a badly handled transition, however that comes about, and not least because I know that in the 9/11 commission report, transition was part of that. For America, how dangerous is a badly handled or overly slow transition?
That's a good question. This is sort of unique. I don't think we've ever been in a position like this. And so even just today, there was a number of stories about, for example, President Trump, you know, fired the Secretary of Defense, fired the person in Homeland Security who was about keeping cybersecurity and keeping the elections and our infrastructure safe. And he's putting in sort of flunkies and toadies and unqualified people to try to push through, you know, I hesitate to even say policies, but almost grievances that he has. And so now, even today, he talked about, I'm going to pull everybody out of Afghanistan, everybody out of Iraq, and everybody out of Syria. And whether or not you believe that those missions are worthwhile, the way that this is being done is so unprofessional. You know, we have allies, the British included, in these places. And, you know, it's clear that none of them were consulted with or dealt with here. So by just acting in this sort of impulsive, not serious way, you're aiding Iran, who wants us out of the region. You're surrendering to the Taliban, which, you know, is a government that we've made deals with to try to negotiate with the Taliban so that the government can stay in place and women can continue to go to school and these kind of things. And so you see the president almost so angry that he lost that he's just trying to burn down the house on the way out. So there's that piece. And then there's the piece of not conceding and not helping to prepare the next administration going. So I think the bigger threat there is not so much on the national security side where I work. Biden has so many experts, so many people that have worked around the world that have relationships. Biden has been in government for decades and has many of these relationships around the world. I think even if he's not getting daily intelligence briefings, he's still in touch with, you know, world-class experts on all these things. The one thing that you know, to sort of a layman on the outside of the thing that's very dangerous is the COVID thing, right? So we're now talking about maybe having some vaccines, but in the next months, we're going to have to come up as a government, you know, a professional government about how do you get these vaccines out? What is the plan to distribute them? Who gets them first? How do we go from just testing and coming up with a vaccine to creating millions and millions of batches of it? How do you work with foreign countries, you know, in terms of who's coming, who has vaccines, you know, who can get it? All these kind of things are, you know, serious work of government. And that's falling by the wayside because the Trump administration refuses to deal with a serious turnover of government.
In terms of COVID and well, global pandemics more broadly, you know, people will assume that the intelligence services, you know, particularly the ones overseas, their main role is, you know, understanding what Iran are doing, North Korea, Russia, and so on. And particularly in your, you know, in your career, where, you know, the enemies were more clearly defined in some ways. Given the way the world has moved, how much does the intelligence community need to be doing things like looking out for risks around viruses, understanding whether information from places where a virus is breaking out is a legitimate source, and even gaining their own intelligence from assets embedded in the scientific community? How much has that changed over the years, and how much will it definitely change in the future as a result of this?
Well, even over my career, you know, things would come up. You know, we're so used to dealing with sort of the, you know, war and peace and military and diplomatic work. But the things that often end up leading to wars or leading to things that cause trouble for governments are things related to climate change or droughts or health catastrophes, or, I mean, even cyber, you know, issues we didn't deal with or didn't understand for a while, narcotics trafficking. These things create, you know, incredible stress on governments and stress on, you know, the international system. And so the intelligence community has to sort of play catch up and try to show some value in those different areas. And so it's sort of, in a competent administration, there should be an ongoing discussion about the role of all of government. So which role will the State Department play? Which will the Defense Department play? Which will the human, you know, Homeland Security and FBI? And so this should be an ongoing discussion to see, you know, what resources are there that the intelligence community has that can play a role in these things. And certainly we do. We have overhead satellites and things that have, you know, ways, thermal imaging and other things that can help us figure out where, you know, there are climate issues. You know, the NSA and others have capabilities that can help us figure out if there's a breakout in a health issue somewhere. So it is something I guarantee that the intelligence community is trying to come together with and grapple with. Now, my career, the intelligence community is a large beast that is providing information to policymakers. You know, my part of the world was espionage, the human running human spies. It's possible that part of the organization too may try to recruit sources that can help us figure out what's happening in labs around the world and health things. But I think it's going to be a bigger issue that's going to be dealt with by other parts of the intelligence community rather than just the spy side of the house.
Yeah. Given obviously the things that you have to do in order to gather your intelligence, particularly on your side, on the, as you say, the human espionage side, knowing that certainly over the last few years at the other end, it's been widely reported that, you know, briefings are not read or read selectively or not even necessarily pushed up to the right people or ignored or used selectively or leaked. How disheartening will it be to the people in the field who are risking presumably not just their lives, but also the lives of their assets to know that maybe this stuff isn't being used in the way it's meant to be?
Well, we're taught that intelligence is just sort of one input into policymaking, right? And so, you know, over the years, there's presidents that assimilated and took on intelligence and took it more seriously than others. And so we don't necessarily expect that, you know, intelligence will always drive policy or that presidents will always be fawning over the information that we give them. But usually there's a professional give and take where, you know, administrations make it clear what information they need. They make it clear if they're getting what they want or don't want. And intelligence professionals are very, very solicitous of trying to get those administrations what they need. And so, you know, Trump sort of berating and not showing interest in intelligence, that's, you know, it's troubling and it's frustrating, certainly. But the bigger concern is sort of the long-term damage done by politicizing the intelligence. President Trump seems to think of our institutions as essentially his personal playthings that he can use to attack political enemies and others. He thinks the intelligence community should essentially be a place where he can cherry pick specific information that that helps him or helps him attack people. So, you know, if he's upset about, you know, the, you know, Russia investigation, he wants to declassify things to sort of, you know, make people that he dislikes look bad. And that's a real danger. You know, the one thing we're taught from day one is, you know, it's politicization of intelligence is ruins the whole thing. There has to be some level of trust that you're providing either facts or some your best guess version of truth or in the best version of what your sources and people are telling you. You're not creating things. You're not twisting things. You're not turning things just to please a certain president or not. Intelligence works best when, you know, sometimes you're providing information that policymakers don't want to hear because, you know, they have policies and they're behind them and they want to support them and they're getting information that undercuts that. And that's, you know, a mature administration understands that and uses that. But, you know, this one, they're looking to undercut and put essentially partisan flunkies into positions that should be held by, you know, serious professionals.
I think given the discussion we're having, I think it's nearly time for a whiskey. You've already got yours. I'm going to pull one in a second. So just one last question on this side of things before we move on to whiskey and other things.
No worries, as many as you want.
So obviously, given that Russia was a big part of your career, both because of the time you were in, but also, you know, the jobs that you did. When in, I think it was the first year of the administration, what I think was publicly reported as some kind of Israeli gained information was shared with the Russian foreign minister in the Oval Office.
Right.
For you who dedicated so much of your working career around the, you know, Russia work, how did that make you feel and everything that sort of led up to that being even a possibility?
Yeah, the entire, you know, support for Vladimir Putin, the summit in Helsinki, where, you know, he essentially threw his own country and intelligence services under the bus in front of Vladimir Putin, his sort of leaking intelligence to Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov and the Russian ambassador. All of these are consistent with this concept that, you know, everything is about him personally and, you know, and in creating sort of this anti-truth. You know, it's just similar to what he did with the election. He primed everybody ahead of the election to say, if I don't win, it's going to be corrupt. It's going to be, you know, a fake election. It's going to be rigged, and says over and over. And so that there's lots of people who are ready to believe such a thing when the election goes off. And that essentially is obviously incredibly debilitating to all those thousands and thousands of people who worked on the election, who took it seriously, who were very careful about doing things, that got the mail to places. And, it, you know, it's very similar with the intelligence community. He is willing to say anything or do anything, truth or not truth, to protect, you know, his perceived needs at any moment. And it's especially frustrating with someone, you know, who worked against Russian intelligence, who studied Russia for a long time, to understand a country whose primary goal is hurting and undercutting the United States and undercutting the U.S. relationship with Europe. To continue to sort of support that and take actions that benefit, you know, essentially an enemy. I mean, the Russians have made it clear that, you know, they treat it like they're in a political war with us. And so to sort of try to help that side is very frustrating, absolutely.
Do you feel like it makes a sort of mockery of the work that you did?
No, yeah. It definitely does. And I'm sure it's got to be really, really dicey. And it's going to be fascinating in the years to come to read books of how did serious professionals in the Defense Department and the FBI and the CIA and other places, NSA, try to engage with this president, because they definitely take their role of providing the president the best intelligence they can. And they will con- continue to try to find ways to do that, even when if the president's irresponsible. They, you know, they're not going to try to undercut, you know, an elected president or any of those kind of things. But it's going to be fascinating to see just, you know, as things come out of the kind of stuff he did and said and how they tried to you know, get him things that they thought he needed to do to protect the country without getting up his ire or putting our sources in a damaging and dangerous position. It's going to be really something. I think some of it has benefited now because it becomes clear that he doesn't care. He's not interested in dealing with COVID. He's not interested really in the truth of what intelligence provides. He only wants, you know, to deal with his sort of personal vendettas and things. And so I don't even think he's had intelligence briefings in a month or so. So, you know, maybe it makes it easier if he doesn't even care.
Well, after that, I think I need a whiskey. So you're ahead of me already. So you're drinking a Scotch.
I have a Lagavulin, an Islay from Scotch. But when I was overseas, so I always drink Scotch. Scotch was sort of the drink of choice. And it wasn't until I came back and retired, and I never drank bourbon very much. So I've started to drink bourbon and have a regular sort of bourbon drink, an old fashioned or a Manhattan or something. And so that's sort of nowadays I'm a bourbon person, but years and years and years of just Scotch.
So I always try and pair a whiskey with my guest appropriately. So I was thinking I was going to go for Cull Ealer, which is the only.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah. Which has got the word CIA in the correct order in the whiskey. But I decided instead, this is the drink I always, when I'm speaking to sort of American patriots, as it were. So I've got a bottle of Eagle Rare single barrel.
I've heard that's very good. Is it good?
It's very good. This is what I give when a couple of friends of mine got green cards. I sent them a bottle of this because it's got an eagle on the front and it feels appropriate for representing America. So
remind me to tell you at the end of this, or I could, after this, my story of Scotland with the your intelligence service in Britain. But and the Scottish distillery. So
cheers.
Cheers.
So actually, before I want to move on to sort of the entertainment business, which I know obviously you work in, but just on the Scotch stuff. So in movies, and this is a nice segue into that, when people are having serious discussions, you know, whether it's actually diplomats or even people in the services, you know, they come into their boss's office, they open the cabinet, they pull out normally a decanter, and they pour out whiskey, and they sort of say, right, you know, you need to do this, or this is over now, or you're going home, or something terrible's happened. How much did, obviously without saying what happened in the discussions, was there sort of a background of Scotch drinking while having serious conversations, or is that just for the movies?
Interesting. So I think, you know, in our service, you know, there was a lot of drinking in the early years. And so by the time I came in, it was almost an issue. There was sort of a generation of people who probably thought that they needed to drink as part of their job. And, you know, there was too many people who became alcoholics and had problems with their families. And so, you know, sort of drinking as part of the job, it was obviously not frowned upon, but there was less of it through much of my career growing up. But your job is to, you know, build relationships and deal with people. So a lot of times you're out spending time with people with good dinners and drinking or wine or scotch or what have you. And so it becomes part of the work. And it, sort of in my later part of my career, I always made sure that I had a little thing where, so if, you know, if someone was leaving after several years, you'd have a scotch with them, or on a Friday you would try to invite the ambassador and something informal to have a scotch or a cigar. And so it became sort of, at least, you know, for me, and I know some of my friends, you know, part of, you know, doing the business without getting carried away.
And presumably also legitimately using alcohol as a way to help get the information you need from an asset, either by building a relationship or allowing them to compromise themselves and say something they shouldn't. Presumably that's a legitimate part of the work that you do.
It's not that you're trying to get people drunk necessarily or whatever, but essentially you're trying to build relationships with people and develop relationships, and essentially whatever it is that they need. If there are people who like to go out and socialize, they like to go eat, if having a few drinks with them is a way to get people talking, and, you know, and likewise, if there's someone who doesn't drink, then you're going to try to find a way to appeal to them. If they want to, they play tennis or they eat, whatever it is, your job is to try to appeal to them and see if they, you know, look at their motivations and what makes them tick. And So if they drink, you're going to drink. And if they don't drink, you're not going to drink. Essentially, you're doing what you need to do to build that relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. So look, let's talk about Spycraft Entertainment. So obviously, you know, you're now out of the service. You're effectively the sort of link between Hollywood and the services, both in terms of consulting on properties that they're working on anyway, but also actually bringing new source material to them.
Yeah, so I retired in 2014 and I did a little bit of writing. I did some work consulting and things sort of, you know, around Washington management issues and things like that. And then a friend of mine who I knew in the service who'd served in India and Afghanistan and Iraq, and you know, his last job was the chief in Berlin. Great storyteller. And when we came out, sort of a weird confluence of events, out of the blue, I got a call from Rob Reiner, you know, who's an All in the Family, sort of just crazy at home one day. And, you know, this was when Trump was starting to look like he might win the election. And Rob Reiner was really upset about a lot of the Russia stuff. And so he called me and asked if he could meet with General Hayden, former CIA director Hayden, and me to talk about Russia things. It was all this great. So we had a good discussion and he filmed it and these type of things. And so when my friend Jerry got out with a group of sort of former clandestine service people telling some stories at a bar, we started chatting and came up with this idea of like, hey, you know, we're always telling these stories, you know, each other to try to appeal to each other. Why don't we see if we can sort of take advantage of this? And, you know, I was bragging about how I knew Rob Reiner, and we sort of came up with this concept of creating a little company to try to engage with Hollywood, because essentially there's a few CIA people over the years who've done things with movies, but a lot of them are not terribly credible or they've been there such a long time. We said, hey, let's see what we can do. And it started with us thinking that we were going to do maybe an unscripted thing like Anthony Bourdain. We would travel around the world instead of eating food. We would, you know, tell spy stories, you know, in Vienna, and then we'd go to Berlin, and then we'd go to Bangkok or what have you, because there's a million stories and we could tell. And as we got out there and started talking to people, we met a number of other people who said, hey, you know, I think the scripted world would be really good for you guys too. You know, if you guys have your own stories, we can help hook you up with writers and producers, and we can go from there. And it sort of built from there. So we're at a point now where we have a lot of our own stories that we sort of talk and work with writers. And at this point, you know, we don't have a lot of money, so we try to convince them that it's worth working with us to try to sell it and make money from it rather than paying a writer to do something. Well, or there's sort of spy stories that are out there, old books, and we've optioned them to see if we can't then work with a writer to make a script out of it to sell it. And so, you know, over time we've developed, you know, a number of projects, and we've sold a few things, and we haven't gotten anything on the air yet because nobody's developing anything now because of COVID. But it's been great fun. And I want to make one point clear is we're not trying to either make the CIA look great, nor are we looking to tear it apart. And we take our obligation to protect our sources and methods and classified information seriously. So just like when I write an article for the New York Times, the Washington Post, I have to send it to CIA to make sure there's not classified information in it. And we do the same here. So it might be a story we know, but we might, you know, change a little bit of the people involved or something, so it's sort of so it doesn't tell secrets, and we check it through the agency. And so that's sort of our model, and it's been a lot of fun.
Do you find yourself, and this is in a couple of different ways that's happened to me, so I'll be watching a movie or a TV show and there'll be whiskey in it, and some of the shows get it badly wrong. So, you know, they're meant to be bringing out the expensive whiskey for some seminal moment, and they use a terribly cheap one. And, you know, I sort of get it wrong, but then notice it when I get it right. But also with my old diplomacy stuff, when I've seen sort of how diplomats are portrayed in movies and TV shows, you know, I either sort of think somebody must have told them something, or think I wish they'd asked somebody, because, you know, no one uses that phrase or language like that. Do you find yourself sort of sitting there watching, and there's plenty of movies that have got spy stories, and thinking that's not how it works, or, oh, that's clever, somebody obviously gave them an inside track? Do you have that sort of ex-intelligence on certain movies?
So really interesting. Like our intent was to sort of create stuff that has a real feel, that has more of sort of how it is. Like there was the HBO special Chernobyl, which, you know, it took a liberty with a bit of information, but it had a real feel to it. And so we're trying to come up with with stories like that. And most Hollywood sort of spy stories, they tend to be sort of in the action thriller genre. So there's always shootings, car chases and stuff. And we never were shooting people or doing car chases as part of our work. It was more Le Carré than Bourne, you know?
Yeah.
And I love those movies. But so we're trying to get a little bit more sort of gritty and realistic. But so people always ask us when we go to these meetings, and I have some today, oh, which shows are the most realistic? Which things make sense? And nothing really is close to sort of our work. There's pieces of shows, you know, the Americans, some of the tradecraft of how they contemplate and think and protect their cover. But then they're shooting people all over the streets of Washington. That's not realistic. And in Homeland, some of the feel when they're in Afghanistan or when they're in Pakistan feels real. But then the fact that, you know, she's sort of crazy and can do whatever she wants. Like, so it's, there's pieces in different things. And then there's some movies you can tell that whoever wrote it didn't have any real knowledge or interest in making this, you know, accurate. But then they must have hired some consultant to tell them. So you'll be watching the story is crazy. It doesn't have anything to do with intelligence. But then some of the details will be exactly right. The file folders will have the right numbers associated, or the badge will look exactly right, or the certain stuff they use. And it's like, so they decided to hire a consultant to get things right, but they didn't care about the story being right. So like, I don't, you know, sometimes I don't understand, like, why do that? Like, for whoever's watching this and enjoying this show, the fact that the badge is the right color is not something that's going to appeal to them, right? So I don't know. It's a weird business.
It's a fascinating, I think, with James Bond, obviously, you know, none of it is based on reality, but there are a few details in them that, you know, if you know, you know. Like, I think there's a scene with when Judi Dench, and there's a picture behind her desk in the movie, which is actually a picture that really is behind the desk. Not, you know, the story is fantastical, but there's one detail that everyone in the services, they get special screenings of these shows. and they're like, oh yeah, I recognize that. And I think that, you know, there's, I'm not sure who it's for, but I think it's a little bit of realism is nice somewhere.
There you go. Yeah. And somebody got to be a consultant and be on the set and probably had a good time, free dinner or something. Yeah.
So given everything that's gone on recently, are you expecting over the next year or so, maybe a whole flood of incredible stories? Because people are, you know, in the way that, you know, when Rex Tillerson stopped working inside, he came outside and told some quite interesting stories with some very graphic language about what was being used. And, you know, sort of that's all gone away now. But presumably there'll be all sorts of fascinating tales that will get told by people once they've retired or once they feel safe because the president's no longer the commander in chief. Are you expecting some good content coming soon?
I don't know if it'll be good content. There are already some of them coming out. There's one on James Comey at the FBI. And based on some of, there's a lot of books on Trump already, and more will come out. So yeah, there definitely will be more and more things, but there will also be more shows that are about something else, but they'll sort of they'll find a way to reference our existence today to sort of bring it home. And so, yeah, there's no shortage of content. That's for sure. And all these streaming services now, they're competing with each other. So there's the Amazons and the Hulus and the Apples and Netflix and everybody trying to sort of get your dollar for streaming. And so it's a real time to sell because there's everybody's trying to get as much content on their platform as they can.
Obviously, you've done it I think it'd be fair to say, you've done it the right way in the sense that, you know, you did 28 years in the service. Obviously, Netflix hadn't been invented at the beginning of your time there. Yeah. You know, even the sort of consultancy with Hollywood thing wasn't really happening when you were in. And then you've left and now you're doing it. Is there a risk that in today's very odd world of social media and wanting insiders, that there'll be some people in the services, either American or other countries, who are taking risks in order to sort of make money and get stories out when it's not yet safe and ready to do so?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I don't have a good answer, but it is a different world. I mean, you know, when I came in and through much of my career, the notion that anybody who worked in CIA would sort of, you know, a director or somebody might write a book and be on TV from time to time. But, you know, if you go now on Twitter, there's tons and tons of intelligence people on, you know, former intelligence people on Twitter and Facebook and these things, and people looking to sort of make content. I'm sure there's some misbehavior there, or some things that come out. It's got to be harder for security services to monitor all those kind of things. There are platforms that Russians, Chinese, and others can use to try to get at people. And we've seen, you know, through LinkedIn, the Chinese intelligence service have you know, got in touch with people and recruited people to spy for them. So there's a lot of things that counterintelligence professionals and things and security people are going to have to really pay attention to sort of in this new world, for sure.
See, just on that, in terms of your own career, obviously, I know you weren't an analyst; you were on the espionage side. But are you glad social media didn't exist when you were doing it, or do you wish it had already?
I'm glad it didn't. You know, it was interesting when I first went overseas. I didn't even make a long distance call back home. I had to go downtown to the, you know, PTT in a city and book time to make a long distance call. And so now, you know, by the time I retired, you know, I could live in Pakistan or something and talk to my kids like this on the video every day, or all my channels, I could watch US sports or whatever I wanted to do that kind of stuff, or sort of get on Twitter. I didn't have social media when I was inside, and so, yeah, it's a really different world in a lot of ways. And a lot of the people coming into the services are such digital natives that there's already rubs. And so they'll say, hey, listen, okay, you're in training now. We're going to send you to this place to do the training. You can't have any electronics here because, you know, you're supposed to be undercover. And foreign services, when you travel overseas, are going to be able to say, okay, you were working in this. I can look at your electronic footprint and see you were working in this CIA base. And if you're someone who spent your life on social media or on your cell phone, all of a sudden you're like, what? You're telling me I can't do these things that are like, you know, like breathing to me? And so I'm sure it's something that all services are having to deal with. You know, in a place like London now, you know, there's cameras everywhere, right? And you know, it's easy to track people by their cell phone and all these other kind of things. And so if you're trying to be clandestine or covert or secret or do your business, it's a much harder environment for those kind of things.
Yeah.
Back in the day, if I was meeting a source in an alley somewhere, you know, I did a surveillance detection run to make sure nobody was following me, and I'm meeting that person in the dark and we're sharing something. When they leave and I leave, I know that there's no chance that anybody's going to know that happened. I don't have any electronics. There's nothing left behind for anybody to figure out we were there. Nowadays, you got to really worry about those things. Mm.
Fascinating. Look, John, we'll move on to our final question, which is, if you could drink any whiskey with anyone, dead or alive, who would it be, where would it be, and what would it be?
Wow. Are you going to tell me what your answer is?
Actually, no one's ever asked me mine. You go first, and I'll give myself time to think of one.
I don't know. I think, you know, I'm a sort of history buff. And so, you know, somebody like, you know, Winston Churchill or somebody like that would be a fascinating person to sit with. And, you know, he was a known sort of storyteller and lived through history and liked to have a drink and a cigar. And so I think he would be a fun person to sit with and have a drink. And I probably would drink an Islay Scotch, maybe even just the fancy bottle of Lagavulin. And if we could do it in 10 Downing Street, that would be, it'd be nice.
Very good. Yeah, that's a great answer. I think mine would be my grandfather, who I never met. So my father's father died when he was quite young. And I think, I've no idea if he drank or not. I know my dad doesn't drink, but I would probably have a Balvenie 50, because somebody else is playing, with the grandfather, Norman, who I never met. Probably, I would have said in his native South Africa, but because I'm so desperate to travel at the moment, I'm going to say at the distillery, because I've been to a distillery, you know, bourbon or scotch for nearly a year now, which is unlike me. So I think that's probably where I'd do it. But
let me tell you my quick version of my story for Her Majesty's government. So when I worked in Russia, there was a source that we had, a very useful source who, for a variety of reasons, security reasons, I won't go into the sensitive part of it, but had to defect and move to the United States. So he was a Russian intelligence officer. His family came out, he was kept safe, and we helped resettle him. And, he's a Russian, he liked his drink. And so, I would sometimes go visit him and bring him a bottle of scotch or something. And at one point, the British intelligence service, who we had regular relations with, said, "Hey, we know that this guy came out. We're very interested. We would really like to talk to him." So I went to see him, and I had a bottle of scotch, and I said to him, "Hey, the British would like to talk to you." And he's like, "I don't know. I'm a little nervous about this. My life." I said, "Listen, they'll do it. It's up to you. They'll do whatever you want. If you want to tell them you want to go," I had the scotch. I said, "Tell them you want to go to Scotland and go to distilleries, and they'll talk to you." And he's like, "Really?" I said, "I don't know. You can ask whatever you want. They can say no." And so we went back to the British and said, "Yeah, he'd like to go to Scotland and go visit the distilleries." And to their credit, Her Majesty's government played for us. We flew over first class, good restaurants in London, up to Scotland, went to a whole bunch of distilleries, stayed overnight. These places, old inns with, layers and layers of old scotch bottles, and you like blow the dust off of that one. I want that one up there. It was fabulous.
Fantastic. You see, I used to do something what we call whiskey diplomacy, where I'd use whiskey to sort of promote the aims of the British government. So I'm glad to see that my former colleagues on the other side were doing it in a much more extreme way. So there you go.
And yeah, it's nice when other people are paying.
Yeah, absolutely. Brilliant. John, look, thank you for your time and insight. I know there's a lot going on and everyone wants to know your view on it, because there's so much of it. It's all so serious. So I appreciate your time today. Thank you very much.
No, my pleasure. I really enjoy what you're doing. So I will make your podcast a regular in my rotation.
I love scotch. 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 Yep.
And don't forget to not just follow us on Twitter and Instagram at US of Dramerica, but also ask us questions and comment and say nice things.
And please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. And if the mood takes you, you can leave us a review, as feedback is always welcome.
And drink whiskey. Sláinte.